From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Mary King. She's written a civil rights memoir titled Freedom Song about her years as communications coordinator of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Also today, I talk with cartoonist Roz Chast. Her quirky, shakily drawn cartoons are a regular feature in The New Yorker magazine. Hammered dulcimer virtuoso John McCutcheon is featured in our weekly performance spot. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Wall Street, director Oliver Stone's view of greed and corruption in the financial world. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is Mary King. She's written a civil rights movement memoir from her perspective as a young white woman who worked in a mostly black, largely male-dominated civil rights group. It's titled Freedom Song, a personal story of the 1960s civil rights movement. During the height of the civil rights movement, from 1962 to 65, King was the communications coordinator for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, working with communications director Julian Bond. SNCC, as the committee was commonly known, was one of the more militant groups working for racial equality and the group that first popularized the term black power. As communications coordinator, it was Mary King's job to get the national media to cover SNCC demonstrations and to report on the beatings and harassment directed against SNCC workers. It was King who called the prisons in Mississippi and the State Highway Patrol, trying to locate three SNCC volunteers, Andrew Goodman, James Cheney, and Mickey Schwerner, who disappeared while traveling through rural Mississippi. All three were later found shot and beaten to death. Mary King left SNCC just before the group voted to expel whites. She later entered government service. President Jimmy Carter appointed her Deputy Director of Action, with responsibility for the volunteers in the Peace Corps and VISTA. Mary King now works in the private sector, trying to open up markets for American technology in the Third World. Her new memoir is called Freedom Song. Mary King, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
I think we all had our consciousness raised watching the evening news in the 1960s and seeing civil rights demonstrators being harassed by police, beaten, hosed with fire hoses, attacked by police dogs. It was your job to get the press to cover those demonstrations. As the communications coordinator, what was the importance of having the press at the demonstrations in the South?
Well, it was more than just getting press coverage. Really, the only protection that we had for civil rights workers was the press. There was no other protection. We have to remember that we were working in an era of state-condoned terrorism or state-conducted terrorism. That is, sheriffs and law officers were either the perpetrators of the violence or in collusion with the vigilantes and terrorists. So then what could we do to offer protection to someone working on voter registration who was picked up and jailed? And in the safety of secrecy, that the sheriffs and the law officers could have had him beaten to smithereens. And many of my fellow workers had jaws broken and noses broken and were very fiercely beaten in jails. If we could get a reporter to a jail with a pad asking and inquiring, are you holding so-and-so in custody? Then the jailer or the sheriff knew that they were under surveillance, and that would modify their behavior somewhat, we hoped. The particular incident that you were talking about in 1964, on June 21, three of my fellow workers disappeared in late afternoon. It was a Sunday. And what I normally did when something like this happened was to call the jails. And so I called the jails in the five counties surrounding Neshoba County, Mississippi, to find out where they were being held. I was almost certain that they had been picked up and were being held in a jail. And I found that Deputy Sheriff Cecil Ray Price lied to me personally. It was later proven in court when he said, no, they're not here, they're not in detention. And not 3 or 4 hours later, he and other law officers took James Cheney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner out and shot them. 44 days later, their bodies were found buried under a dam. So the role of the press, it was not only so much in demonstrations, because the peak demonstrations that you now see replayed in a 10-second segment on the news when they talk about the civil rights movement, this is not really what the movement was about. The movement was tedious. And it was laborious. It was changing the hearts and minds of people. It was helping people who lived in fear under the rigid protocols of segregation to overcome that fear and to be willing to go down to register and vote.
So the press offered you at least two things. One was education for people who weren't present, and the other was a sense of security that with people watching, the demonstrators were less likely to be mistreated by the authorities. Was it hard to get the national press to come to small towns in the South to cover the demonstrations?
Very hard. You know, going back to the days of Rutherford B. Hayes, there had been a national deal cut that the country would look the other way and let the South do as it pleased with regard to black people. In the South itself, a black death was not considered newsworthy. If you read about a black person in the newspaper, it was usually about a crime, and they wouldn't even refer to that person by name. They would say the Smith woman or the Jones man. They wouldn't say Mr. Jones or Mrs. Smith as a gesture of ridicule or degradation. So we really had a problem because in order to make the rest of the country aware of what was going on, we had to have the press. We also needed the press for protection internally. The government of South Africa knows exactly what it's doing in banning the world's press, because if you can't hold up atrocities to the light of a larger morality, then the perpetrators of them are not forced to re-examine their behavior, and they can get away with blue murder, literally.
What did you do to get the press to come when you were having trouble?
Well, Julian Bond and I had a rather elaborate mechanism. We worked through Friends of SNCC organizations in other cities, Princeton, Portland, New York, Boston, Los Angeles, and so on, Chicago. And we would call when one of our workers was arrested or in jail or we heard that something had happened. We would call and alert them. They would then query the wire services and say, are you carrying a story on such and such? Of course, the wire services weren't carrying the story, because the people in the state level and the Atlanta Bureau didn't think it was worth carrying in 99 out of 100 cases. But the fact that the inquiry had come in from Portland would mean that the wire services would then have to respond and they would have to send someone out to that jail to find out if they were there and being held. And by the time it went out from the Atlanta Bureau to the Northwest, that meant it had covered the country. So this was a rather elaborate network of contacts that Julian and I plied to get the news stories out across the nation.
Is there any one demonstration where you thought that the presence of the national media really had a profound effect?
Well, I think that the Birmingham situation in 1963, where there were police dogs and fire hoses were used against children, that this really startled the country. Americans were revolted when they saw this. I think that that had an effect. But I'm reminded more of situations where we couldn't get the effect, such as when I was in Danville, Virginia. And again, fire hoses were being used to wash people down the steps of the courthouse, people trying to register to vote. One night there was a prayer vigil, and 48 people were hospitalized as a result of the police brutality used on them afterwards. And I was indicted for acts of war and violence very shortly after I arrived in the town and had to escape across the state line to North Carolina, where a group of Roman Catholic nuns gave me asylum in a convent. And Richard Valeriani was there from NBC, and there were a couple of reporters from the Washington Post. But by and large, the situation in Danville was not covered by the news media. Had it been, it was a situation every bit as bad as Birmingham, and in some ways more so. The judge wore a pistol strapped to his waist in the courtroom. He arrested lawyers right in the middle of the courtroom. The whole justice system and the city hall was completely corroded by its insistence on adhering to the protocols of segregation. We really needed the press, and we couldn't get much in that situation.
My guest is Mary King, and she's written a memoir about her years in the civil rights movement. It's called Freedom Song, and she worked as communications coordinator for SNCC in part of the 1960s. You were a woman in SNCC who rose to a position of authority working with the media. Was there an obvious division of labor between the men and the women in SNCC during the years that you were there?
No, I would not call it a division of labor. I would say that there was a kind of tradition at work in which most of the spokespersons for the organization were male. But SNCC distinctively was responsive to the leadership of women in a way that the other civil rights organizations were not. SNCC had more women and more whites than all of the other organizations put together. And SNCC was open to Ella Baker, for example, was our senior advisor. And SNCC, an older, middle-aged black woman who had earlier been an advisor to Dr. King and was really pushed out of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, she was our senior advisor. She's a major political voice of American political struggle in the 20th century who's been looked over and missed. And I write about her influence on my own personal life, but also her influence on us was profound. And one of the things that she believed was that leadership must come from the bottom. And it was because of her influence and the importance of promoting local and indigenous leadership that a woman like Fannie Lou Hamer came to the fore. She was the last of 20 children in a sharecropper who'd been picking cotton since she was six and had no education, was evicted from a plantation when she registered to vote, but she went on to become a national orator and an organizer of great significance in Mississippi. Only in SNCC could that have happened.
Well, you know, you suggest in your book that one of the reasons why SNCC was less patriarchal than some of the other civil rights organizations was that it was one of the few organizations that wasn't based in the church and that wasn't therefore following the patriarchal model of the church.
Well, I think that's right. The Southern Christian Leadership Conference was much closer to the traditional ministerial leadership, and it defined its role as working to organize within the esteemed institution of the black church. SNCC was more diverse. We were more political. We were closer to the ground, and we were very, very young, Terry. Most of us were 22, 23. If you were 25, you were older. And we really didn't have careers. We weren't married. We didn't get salaries. We paid $9.64 every other week. We had nothing to lose. You know the popular song, "Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose." We could afford to take a quite pure position on matters of leadership because we had so little built up for ourselves to lose.
But there were still obviously some inequities between men and women in the organization. And you wrote what is probably one of the first position papers from within the civil rights movement about the importance of equality between the sexes as well as between the races. And you quote an excerpt of that statement you wrote in your book, and I'd like to ask you to read part of the statement you wrote about sexism in the movement.
Well, I wrote this in 1964 when I was advocating for the SNCC staff that women's rights ought to be a part of the social justice agenda. What was really under consideration at that time, Terry, was whether we should become more democratic in our organization or more highly structured, more hierarchical. And I and another woman, Casey Hayden, along with Bob Moses and a number of others, argued for a more democratic method of decentralized, lots of local movements, each organized around their own passion or their own need. And in that context, in arguing for a more democratic approach, Casey and I said, well, women ought to be, the concerns of women ought to be able to be responded to within this context. And when I wrote this, I was afraid to circulate it with my name on it. And Casey and I polished it up, and then we circulated it anonymously because we were so afraid of ridicule. And when I read it today, it will seem amazing that in 1964, we could have been afraid of ridicule in a radical, militant civil rights organization. And the statement read, "The average white person finds it difficult to understand why the Negro resents being called boy or being thought of as musical or athletic, because the average white person doesn't realize that he assumes he is superior." Note the he's. "And naturally, he doesn't understand the problem of paternalism. So, too, the average SNCC worker finds it difficult to discuss the woman problem because of the assumption of male superiority. Assumptions of male superiority are as widespread and deep-rooted and every bit as crippling to the woman as the assumptions of white supremacy are to the Negro." And I believe this must have been one of the earliest articulations of that parallel.
Now, you said that you were afraid to sign your name to the statement because you thought you would be ridiculed. What made you think that?
There was brooding silence in those times. The word feminism did not exist. Much of the lingo of the women's movement today, the words hadn't even been coined. There was no awareness of women's rights. In law schools, there was no teaching of the question. This is something that has come on the stage in the United States in our very recent past.
Did being a white woman make it harder, too? Did you think that your intentions were going to be misunderstood because you were white and you were referring to black male chauvinism?
Well, this is a very interesting question. You know, my father was the sixth Methodist minister in five generations of Virginia and North Carolina-born Methodist ministers. And sometimes I felt that my Southern roots and my church roots were more significant than my being white. This began to change moving toward 1965. We had experienced a number of very disenchanting experiences. For example, with the death of the three men in Mississippi, President Johnson called the parents, the family of Andrew Goodman and Michael Schwerner, the two whites, and only a presidential assistant called the family of Jim Cheney, the one black among the three to be killed. The following year, in 1965, the Selma March began around the death of a teenage pulpwood cutter, black, Jimmie Lee Jackson, who was killed as he tried to help his mother and grandfather, who had been clubbed by the police in a demonstration. And he died. A few days later, a white minister came in from Boston, the Reverend James Reeb, and he was killed by a group of white thugs who attacked him outside a cafe. This time the entire country responded, but once again President Johnson sent Air Force One for his widow and flowers, and again only a presidential assistant called the family of Jimmie Lee Jackson. So we were encountering institutionalized racism at the very highest levels, right in the White House, in a White House that was, many people think, trying to do its best in the matter of race. We were experiencing the kind of hypocrisy of racism that was woven right into the fabric of America. And by 1965, many people began to wonder whether our nonviolent appeals for change were going to work. And in that atmosphere, as there was more and more disillusionment, we began to hear some of the rhetoric coming out of the northern urban ghettos, and more young people coming into SNCC at that time from those ghettos brought with them the talk of black separatism. Now, my way of looking at that today is entirely different from my way of looking at it then. At the time, I felt great pain because I had put my life on the line. I believed heart, mind, body, and soul I was committed to my fellow workers, and I would willingly have died for any of them. But as I heard the language of black nationalism, I didn't really understand it. Today, I realize very clearly that the question, are we Americans or are we Africans, still lingers in the minds of black Americans. And until black Americans know the answer to that question is an easy one, until black Americans can say, yes, we are fully, totally citizens, we are no longer a captive people, then there will always be logic to those who argue we must separate, we cannot find our destiny within the mainstream. At the time, I didn't realize that.
I want to get back to some of these issues in a couple of seconds, but we have to take a short break first. My guest is Mary King, and she's written a memoir about her years in the civil rights movement when she worked with SNCC. The book is called Freedom Song. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Mary King is my guest, the author of the new civil rights memoir, Freedom Song. I want to get back to the statement that you read, the statement which you had written about sexism within the civil rights movement. You were afraid you were going to be ridiculed and laughed at. What reactions did you get when the statement was anonymously circulated. Well, let's start with the men. What kind of reactions did you get from the men?
Oh, we did get a lot of ridicule and a lot of joking. There were a few people who were very sympathetic and proud of it, Bob Moses and Charlie Cobb, and there were others who were warm to it. But by and large, there was a fair amount of ridicule. It was early for this question to be raised.
And from women in SNCC?
Oh, great coolness. Very great remoteness on the part of most of them. It was many, many, many years later until I realized that the black men in SNCC today are extremely proud that the women's movement was really, in a sense, catalyzed from within the civil rights movement. And those the two papers that Casey and I wrote played a role in that. Today, black SNCC workers are very proud because they regard the women's movement as an inheritor movement to the civil rights movement. But at that time, they did not see it in that way.
No, I want to ask you something that I asked you a couple of minutes ago, which was if you felt more uncomfortable writing this statement, being a white in a predominantly black group. Maybe what you were trying to say is that you hadn't really thought about it at the time you'd written it, that issue wasn't important to you?
That issue hadn't really emerged as an issue. I think that my proximity to the suffering of black people, the experiences I had spent Christmas in jail in 1963 in Atlanta for ordering a cup of coffee with my fellow workers, separated from the black SNCC workers that I was with because they wouldn't allow us to be together. So another woman, Nancy Stearns, now a civil liberties lawyer in New York, and I were thrown in with the white women prisoners. But I think that my awareness had begun to change because of my proximity to black belt, black people. And that is what induced in me an understanding of my position as a woman. If I was working on self-determination for blacks, eventually self-determination came to mean self-determination for me as a woman. And I think that my awareness was more of my being a woman than it was of my being white, although I think that may have compounded it.
I want to talk a little bit about what it was like for you to be a white working in a predominantly black organization at the height of the civil rights movement. And there's an image that really sticks in my mind. I think it was the first time you were arrested for a demonstration with a lot of other people. You were all thrown into prison. But there were two white women in the demonstration, and you were both put in the white part of the prison, and you were separated from all the other demonstrators, which meant that you were deprived of the kind of solidarity and strength that people who were imprisoned in groups had.
That's right.
You couldn't be singing freedom songs
with
everyone.
Right.
It must have been must have made you very aware of the fact, too, that you were white, that you were going to be seen differently, at least by outsiders.
Yes. It was very lonely and extreme situation for Nancy Stearns and me to be and locked up and separated. And we tried to get with the others. When the very bored jailers began to process us, they turned to Nancy and me and said, "What is your race?" And both of us looked at each other for an instant and blurted out, "We're Negro." And the processing jailer turned to his superior and uttered a series of expletives and said, here's some white girls who say they're colored. Now what are we going to do? But they refused to put us in with our fellow workers. And that was a very awful experience. We didn't dare tell anyone why we had been arrested because we saw the women prisoners fighting among themselves, and we knew that we would have been attacked and beaten if we had told anyone why we were there. When they asked us, we simply said what our charge was. Our charge was trespassing, and we just answered with that one word.
SNCC went through many changes during the years that you worked there, and one of the changes was the vote to expel whites. No, you left the group shortly before that. That's a decision that's still, I think, discussed as one of the great controversies that came out of the civil rights movement.
I spent a long time working on that part of the book. It was very difficult for me, and it was emotionally difficult for me writing that whole section. I finally believe that I came to grips with it, and I feel very very proud and very comfortable with my analysis of the situation. At the time, it was difficult, and I think it was difficult for everyone. And I think that there were many, many pressures on us that only came to light later, including infiltration. There is now evidence that there were agents provocateurs who were infiltrated into SNCC from some northern groups to make us more quote-unquote revolutionary. There was also evidence of the FBI's involvement. So it's a complex, not easy to read picture. But I worked very, very hard on it, and I had many, many nights of sleeplessness and many tears over it. But when I finished, I felt good.
So you feel like you can understand in a way that you couldn't understand at the time the decision to keep the organization,
yes,
a black organization.
I think my readers will understand, too.
In the connections that you've made between feminism and the civil rights movement, did being an early feminist help you understand that as well?
Oh, yes, I think so. One's awareness of oneself as different or separate or estranged, that awareness feeds all questions involving identity.
Still, when you left SNCC, you also left being at the center of the civil rights movement. Was it hard for you to find a way to keep those ideals in your life, even though you are no longer an important part of an organization?
Well, SNCC was unique, a unique phenomenon in American political life. We were the most fiercely democratic organization that I've ever known, and had a kind of freedom insofar as our own ability to raise questions with astounding implications was concerned. We were going to the heart of some very fundamental questions involving the American democracy. We were doing so within our own framework, a very diverse, small group, and yet very powerful at the same time. And I realized as time went on after leaving that there would never be anything like this again in my life, that it was a moment in time that would never again come, and that I would have to continue to work based on those values, but I would have to structure them without the support of a group like SNCC. And it took me a while to do so, but I believe that I've done that.
Are you still in touch with all the people who you knew during the civil
rights
movement?
Many of them. A great many of them. Mike Thelwell, who's now a professor at the University of Massachusetts, Bernice Johnson Reagan at the Smithsonian, sociologist Joyce Ladner.
I think it's fair to say that many of the groups who started after the foremost groups of the civil rights movement really owe a debt to the civil rights movement in the organizing style of the groups and in their tactics.
Yes, and in their insight into how to bring about change in a liberal democracy such as ours, because we do have a very flexible system in our Western democracy. And much of what happened subsequently with the anti-war movement, the women's movement, later the environmental movement, is attributable not only in tactics and strategy, but also the basic philosophy of a responsive democracy and basic techniques for organizing, all trace back in some way, through the 1970s and the 1980s. They trace back to SNCC in the early 1960s.
Mary King, I want to thank you for sharing some of your experiences and insights with us today. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
My guest has been Mary King. She's written a memoir of her experiences as the communications coordinator for SNCC during the civil rights movement. It's titled Freedom Song, and it's published by William Morrow. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with composer Philip Glass. His repetitive rhythmic music has been described as minimalism, but he has created some of the most ambitious new operas of the past decade, including Einstein on the Beach, Satyagraha, and Akhenaten. So I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, cartoonist Roz Chast says you can never really tell what might end up in a cartoon. Her weird views of everyday life are a regular feature of The New Yorker magazine. Also, musician John McCutcheon performs a holiday medley, as well as one of his own compositions. McCutcheon has brought innovation to one of the oldest of traditional instruments, the hammer dulcimer. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Wall Street, Oliver Stone's new movie starring Charlie Sheen and Michael Douglas. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson in Washington. Former Wall Street investor Ivan Boesky was sentenced to 3 years in prison today for his part in the stock market's biggest insider trading scandal. More from NPR's Barbara Mantell.
Last spring, Boesky pleaded guilty to one criminal count of making false statements to the Securities and Exchange Commission about his stock positions. He could have received a maximum of 5 years in prison. The 3-year sentence is considered a surprise. Many observers had expected a 1 or 2 year sentence because of Boesky's extensive cooperation with the government in its ongoing investigation. But at the same time, the judge said he had to consider the magnitude of Boesky's crime and the message sent to the rest of Wall Street. Boesky is still cooperating with the government. He most likely will not begin serving his sentence until March of 1988. I'm Barbara Mantell in New York.
The House of Representatives disciplined one of its own today. Representative Austin Murphy of Pennsylvania was reprimanded for ethics violations. He was charged with one count of putting a no-show employee on his payroll and one count of diverting House resources such as photocopy equipment and long-distance phone service. Murphy got the least severe form of discipline. He could have been publicly censured before his peers, or he could have lost his seniority or been expelled. A sharp decline in farm subsidies pushed personal income down 0.4% last month. The Commerce Department says it's the first decline in more than 2 years and the sharpest drop in more than 15 years. But Larry Kimmerine of Wharton Econometrics says if you exclude the farm subsidies, the figures look a lot better.
A 0.7% increase is pretty good. If anything, it's even slightly higher than we had earlier in this year. So I would say, despite what looks like a decline, it's actually a relatively good report.
Savings as a percentage of disposable personal income fell from 5% in October to 3.8% in November. The Labor Department reports that consumers faced higher inflation last month. The Consumer Price Index rose 0.3% in November. At the same time, the Commerce Department said U.S. personal income last month dropped 0.4%, the first decline in nearly 2 years. Israeli soldiers killed 2 more Palestinian protesters in the Gaza Strip today. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
Israeli security forces opened fire on demonstrators in Gaza today when some in the crowd threw stones. A report on Israeli radio said petrol bombs were also thrown. A 29-year-old man and a 13-year-old boy were killed. At the main hospital in Gaza, there were clashes between Israeli soldiers and Palestinians as the soldiers tried to enter the hospital. In the past few days, Israeli troops have been reinforced in Gaza. Soldiers patrol the refugee camps and guard the roads to stop youngsters from setting up burning tires to block traffic. Earlier today in Jerusalem, Israeli soldiers fired tear gas into a demonstration in the Muslim quarter of Jerusalem's Old City. The demonstrations began after Friday prayers. Later today, a 70-year-old man who was in the mosque died. In Jerusalem, this is Deborah Amos reporting.
The Islamic Jihad for the Liberation of Palestine is threatening to kill 4 Western hostages. The Jihad said it will avenge the deaths of the Palestinian protesters killed by Israeli soldiers in the Gaza Strip. The Jihad statement was delivered to an independent newspaper in Beirut. It was accompanied by Polaroid photographs of 2 of the American hostages the Jihad is holding, Robert Polhill and Jesse Turner. Turner and Polhill were kidnapped along with American Alan Steen and an Indian national. A big gain on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 50 points to close at 1975.30. That's a gain of nearly 108 points for the week, the biggest ever. Trading was very heavy. 275 million shares changed hands. You're listening to National Public Radio in Washington. I'm Mara Liasson.
This is Fresh Air. The hammered dulcimer is an instrument usually associated with traditional music, but ever since John McCutcheon started playing, he's been experimenting with its sound and design. He's even performed and recorded with an electric band. Today he joins us for a solo acoustic set.
Hammered dulcimer, you know, is one of those instruments that visited a lot of different cultures before it finally made its way into the United States in the early 1600s. It's popular in Western Europe and in Eastern Europe, especially where it's called the cimbalum. In the Middle East, the santur and santuri are classical instruments. And I guess when I started playing, I started experimenting with all those different cultural influences from Erev Shel Shoshanim, the Hebrew piece that opened up that little set, through New Year's Eve, an original piece of mine, and a traditional Irish tune. At the end, over the last 15 years that I've been playing, I've been adding chromatic notes and damped systems and doing all kinds of stuff. So I figured I'd sort of relive an experience I had about a year ago now, when I was watching a migration of gray whales out on the West Coast, and it was a really musical, visual experience. And came home from that trip and started evolving this piece called Leviathan.
Thank you.
John McCutcheon lives in Charlottesville, Virginia, but is frequently on tour. The holiday tunes he played are featured on his album Winter Solstice. His latest album is Gonna Rise Again. Both are on the Rounder label. This is Fresh Air. The cartoons of Roz Chast are regularly published in The New Yorker magazine. You can always recognize one of her cartoons. Each frame is outlined in thin, squiggly lines and captioned in her wiry, nervous print. But her ideas are even more distinctive about anxieties, objects, and abstractions that few cartoonists could tackle. Her new book, Mondo Boxo, is a collection of her cartoon short stories. In the story, How Are Clichés Made?, she describes the cliché world plant in Matawan, New Jersey. Then there's Camp Mandatory Fun, where you'll have lots of fun or else. And she describes the perfect family. They don't use very much salt, but when they do, it's sea salt. Please take a good look at the label, because if you try to buy some, you will probably get the wrong brand.
I guess they're just sort of this sort of perfect, obnoxious little family that you read about a lot in magazines and newspapers, and they're always doing everything sort of right, and they eat right, and they keep fit, and they like themselves a whole lot, and they're very clever, and I'm very happy for them, really.
Are you really? You resent them.
I don't know if I really resent them. I think they're kind of funny.
Did you ever want to be perfect yourself like that?
Oh, of course. I mean, you know, especially when you read about these, oh, I don't know, I can't remember her name. She's some hostess and she has some book out, and I saw her on TV and she was so funny. She was just talking about setting a table for a company, and she just went on and on and on about the placemats and the napkins and the fork and the knife and the spoon and this glass and that glass, and everything was very clever, and, you know, it was like cauliflower centerpieces, and I mean, it was just it just was sort of funny.
Now, you have another cartoon.
But, I mean, I admire her, too, you know.
Should we call them cartoons? Because they're little,
sure.
Stories here.
Yeah, they're cartoons.
Okay. You have one cartoon called Poets on Strike, about the great poetry strike of 1989, in which they brought in scabs, but the scabs only wrote things like roses are red, violets are blue, sugar is white. And after 6.5 months, an agreement was reached, and even the most depressed poet was happy, sort of. That cartoon made me think of what an unusual job you have. Kind of like the poets going on strike. Poets don't go on strike. Nobody notices poets. And cartoonists, I mean, you're at home all day, most likely, trying to come up with ideas. Is that a difficult and lonely life?
There are times when it's harder than others. When it's going well, it seems like the easiest job in the world. And when it's not, then it's, I wouldn't say, you know, necessarily the hardest job in the world, but then it's just harder.
What do you do when it's time to turn one out and the idea isn't coming?
Kind of maybe go to the kitchen and eat a graham cracker and, wander to the other end of the apartment and panic, cry. I definitely have times where I just feel it's, you know, completely hopeless, absolutely. But I guess I've been doing this for, you know, not forever, but for a number of years, so that so far, at least, it's been my experience that those times do pass.
What got you first interested in cartoons? Did you read them when you were growing up?
I always liked to look at cartoons when I was a kid.
Which kinds did you read?
I liked Charles Adams a whole lot.
He was in The New Yorker.
Yeah. I saw The New Yorker when I was growing up. Used to look at the cartoons. But the cartoons that made the biggest impression on me, I guess, were Charles Adams. I just thought he was just terrific. Still do.
What about comic books?
They weren't really that approved of when I was a kid by my parents, so I didn't really do a ton of comic book reading until I was a little bit older. 25, 30, no.
You went to college at the Rhode Island School of Design. Did you want to be a painter or an illustrator when you went to school?
I kind of had some dreams about being a painter for a while. I did major in painting, and I really liked it, but I'm sort of a bad painter, so I didn't really follow that up.
Well, when you were in school, were you able to tell teachers that your real ambition was to be a cartoonist? Would that have been taken seriously?
I don't think that I really had it as an ambition, because I really didn't think that what I did, I didn't really know that it could be a job, really.
When you got out of school, did you try to get a job before becoming a freelance cartoonist?
What did I do? No, I just really started taking... Well, I for a while I thought I would be very practical and do illustration. And I did take around a portfolio for that for a little while, and I got a tiny bit of work doing that. But it wasn't really... It was sort of depressing.
Are there things that come your way that you save because you know that there will eventually be a good idea for a cartoon?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I don't even know if I think that directly. I do save things here and there that may never find their way into a cartoon, but that I kind of like.
Such as?
Recently I got something. I guess it's a company called the Wisconsin Cheese Man, and it's these huge. Well, I guess since it's the Christmas season and all that, it's these huge crates of arrangements of cheeses and summer sausages and petits fours and weird sauces, and it's all arranged so there's like a big cheese in the center, and then it's like a mandala. But of
I know exactly what you mean. And is there a little like green, the equivalent of confetti, you know, around it to make it look
like,
festive,
like a lawn kind of,
yeah,
or
exactly.
Something.
So this is going to be used as a cartoon, do you think?
Oh, I doubt it. Maybe in a cartoon about something else. Completely, that might have a little tiny, you know, cameo role or something.
But that's one of the things I really love about your cartoons. Everything really rings true. There's all these little details about life. Like when you draw that cartoon and there's a little image in passing with this cheese box, I'm going to recognize it because I've seen these cheese boxes. It's those details, I think, that, among other things, that really make your cartoons so special.
Oh, well, thank you.
What else are you saving now?
Oh, let me see. Ugh, I have all kinds of ridiculous things. How to keep hamster manuals, and what do I have? I have a book called Chickens in Your Backyard. I don't know whether these will ever show up in cartoons. They're just things that I collect that I think are funny, and, you know, they might not. I don't know.
You know, when I first started seeing your cartoons, and I saw that they were by R. Chast, I said to myself, is it a man or a woman? Did people ever think you were a man before you became known as Roz Chast?
Yes, I still occasionally get letters, believe it or not, to Mr. Roz Chast, which is, you know, really insisting on, you know, something. But I just sort of stuck with it. Well, I did go through a tiny phase for a few weeks, I think it lasted, of signing my name Roz Chast, because an editor... A woman editor had said to me, well, you're a woman cartoonist and you should let people know you're a woman. And, you know, I mean, that it may be right, but I felt funny. I felt every time I signed it, it's like, oh, well, now she likes me more because I'm signing my name like this. I guess now I'm better in her book. And I felt stupid doing it. I just, you know, said, well, this is not how I really sign my name. This is, I sign it R. Chast. That's how I sign it.
But that's interesting. So you never decided to sign it R. Chast to keep your sexual...
No, that's...
Your gender unknown.
No, not at all. I mean, obviously, if I wanted to do that, in the contents in the New Yorker, when they list the cartoons, I would have had them print R. Chast there, but, you know.
Your husband is a writer.
Yes.
Do you talk about your work much with each other? Or do you try to keep that out of the relationship?
Well, it would be really impossible to keep it out of the relationship. And we do talk about it some. I think that it's a... We have an area where it overlaps, and then an area where I might talk more to my cartoonist friends, and he might talk more to his writer friends.
Let me just ask you one last question. Did you, when you started cartooning, did you approach it with the idea of wanting to do it differently than it had been done before?
No, this is not really. This is just really the way I draw. And when I tried to do it the same as other people, I knew that that was really... that. Didn't work at all. That was a disaster. I guess some people, when they get out of college, they really are very much in a lather about what they're going to do next. But I mean, at the time that I started, I just knew that this is really what I like to do.
Okay, Roz, I want to thank you.
Well, you're
very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Cartoonist Roz Chast. Her new book, Mondo Boxo, is published by Harper & Row. You're listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne co-hosts the program, and she's joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What's coming up?
Well, tonight we'll have a report on new findings on AIDS, which have prompted the Defense Department to reassign people who test positive for the virus out of high-stress, high-performance jobs. Also, America's most famous inside trader, Ivan Boesky, is sentenced today, and we'll have a report on that. And our man in Havana, Tom Miller, chats with us about the Cuban Film Festival. Terry, you might be interested to discover that the politically correct left-wing movies did not sweep the prizes. A big winner at the festival was American-made, a decidedly lowbrow comedy. And I won't give the title away, but here's a hint. Cheech.
Okay, thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. With so many new movies opening for the holidays, our film critic Stephen Schiff is working overtime. Today he has a review of Oliver Stone's new movie Wall Street. It's about a different kind of war than the one Stone portrayed in Platoon. The fighting in this film takes place downtown in a pinstriped urban jungle.
Oliver Stone has an Old Testament sensibility. In his world, there is good and there is evil. There are saints and there are devils. There's temptation and there's hell to pay. Now, when a director has an Old Testament sensibility, problems arise. He may, for instance, tend to moralize, and Wall Street's preachiness will at times drive you up the wall. But Old Testament moralists can also be great myth-makers, imagists who paint their lessons on broad canvases in thrilling, colorful strokes. And that's what Stone has done in Wall Street. He's created a smashing myth of good and evil wrestling for a young broker's soul. What makes this myth scary and exhilarating is the way Stone gives the devil his due. Like Platoon, Wall Street centers on the travails of an innocent, again played by Charlie Sheen. And like Platoon, Wall Street gives Sheen two father figures to choose from, one saintly, one demonic. The saintly one is his dad. He's a union boss at a small airline who inadvertently gives his son an insider trading secret. Sheen's real-life father, Martin Sheen, is fine in the role, but not exactly magnetic. Not like the movie's devil figure, a corporate raider named Gordon Gekko. In the world of Wall Street, if a young broker can inspire Gecko's interest, he's off to high roller heaven. He also gets to listen to a lot of juicy, tough guy dialogue.
If you're not inside, you are outside, okay? And I'm not talking about some $400,000 a year working Wall Street stiff, flying first class and being comfortable. I'm talking about liquid. Rich enough to have your own jet. Rich enough not to waste time. $50, $100 million, buddy. A player. Or nothing. Now you had what it took to get into my office. The real question is whether you got what it takes to stay.
That's Michael Douglas as Gordon Gekko, and frankly, I didn't know he had it in him. Douglas has always been just a comely lump on the screen, but here, with his hair slicked back and his lapels slicing a path through the urban jungle, he creates an obscenely attractive portrait of the financial buccaneer in action, a gleaming mentor from hell. What makes Wall Street pop and sizzle is the way it lets transgression look desirable. As Sheen sells and sells his soul, we watch him grow suaver and better dressed. We see the pleasures of the limo life, of good food and expensive women and respect from the toughest of the tough. The allure is heady and palpable. In his new novel, The Bonfire of the Vanities, Tom Wolfe calls these gods of finance the masters of the universe, and Wall Street makes you understand how that feels. Here Stone proves his artistry. Among the Aries of wealth and power, his camera jumps and staggers and stalks like a wary prize fighter. Up in Sheen's brand new and hilariously ghastly high-rise apartment, Stone's camera hovers near the windows so that you can feel how thin the air is up there, how precarious life can be at the top of the corporate ladder. The film's bracingly nasty dialogue and that jittery camera make you high so that towards the end, when Stone begins sermonizing in earnest, you can't help but feel resentful and a little bit hungover. Wall Street the movie is like Wall Street the institution. It finally crashes, but it's a terrific ride while it lasts.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Here's a look at the next fresh air. Next time, I'll speak with obituary writer Jim Nicholson. He'll talk about his unconventional approach to this standard newspaper feature. He overlooks the famous, preferring to celebrate the lives of bartenders, janitors, taxi drivers, and tavern owners. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will review the new album by soprano saxophonist Steve Lacy. It's called Momentum. And television critic David Bianculli will review a production of Harold Pinter's one-act play, The Room, directed by Robert Altman. It airs next week on ABC. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.